And I remember just like walking around in awe of this space that, you know, in some ways, a club is in a lot of ways like a church, right? You have the music, you have the community, you have like, I guess you could even say the communion. Of course, you're not getting drunk off the wine from communion, but there are so many parallels in like the way that you move your body and the way when you're praying together, like you move your body together. There are like so many structural parallels that underlie these two different social experiences. And for me, I'm not saying that my time my first time at the gay bar was spiritual. It wasn't. But it certainly was like profound, and it certainly was something.
And you did get on your knees.
I certainly did.
Hello, my name is Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So we seem to have, in the last few months, had quite a lot of religious guests. And it sounds like I'm complaining there. I'm not complaining. I've really enjoyed all of the conversations, and I don't think that religion is a dirty word. Well, maybe I do. Anyway, doesn't matter. With my guests, I've had quite a lot of conversations about how religion is in conflict with queerness and all of the issues that that can create. But one of the angles that we haven't really looked at all that much is the similarities between religion and queerness, and dare I say, religion and the experience of being in a gay bar. And there probably isn't that many overlaps, to be completely honest, but what stuck out for me in this week's conversation is that they both offer community and they both offer that promise of belonging. And that might not have specifically been what this week's guest, Dr. Luke Wilson, was seeking in either. But it was that sense of longing for belonging. Oh, that rhymed. Longing for belonging and longing for community that I came away pondering. So to give you a little bit of background, Luke was an evangelical Christian, which is kind of like next level Christian. It's like proper big bad boss Christian. And yeah, I mean, these aren't his words, but it gave him a sense of certainty. It gave him some control in aspects of his life. But it also threw up all of those conflicts that you would imagine a queer person might experience when embracing religion. And it was at an unknown gay bar in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where he happened to be visiting for a conference because he is a university scholar, smart type. And this is where he first got a peek at what it might mean if he left his religion behind and embraced all sides of his queerness. Before we get into the conversation, the only other thing that I want to make you aware of is that Luke is the academic sort, as I've said, and has studied at a number of universities, and those come up in the conversation. We kind of zigzag around all the different cities and locations that he's been in, but when he starts talking about Vanderbilt or McMaster or Liberty, just know that those are universities. Okay, let's get into it. Evangelicalism. No, wait. Evangelicism? Right. No.
Evangelicalism.
Is it evangelicalism?
It is.
So what's evangelicism? Did I just make that up?
Yes.
Okay.
You did. Though not the first, maybe you're not the first person to say that. I've had a lot of people ask me about evangelicism, and I just pretend that they said evangelicalism and go from there and then slip in my pronunciation of the word, which is evangelicalism, as I go, and then they realize as they go, oh, might be a wee bit
Do you emphasize the word when you say it in order to subtly shame them?
No, I want to be as subtle as possible in the most Canadian way, right? You just don't want to offend anyone. So you just kind of keep it, hope that your audience is prepared to pick up on it, that they have the ears to hear, to use a biblical metaphor.
Okay. Just for the record, I'm not going to be picking up the subtle hints you're putting down. So if there's anything you need to say as this conversation carries on, then you say it, okay?
Be blunt.
Oh, no, that's asking you to undo years of learned behavior. Sorry.
I will do nothing of the sort.
I will be polite until the end. Okay, right. So evangelicalism.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. You got it.
Why don't you tell me in 5 words or less what hearing the word evangelicalism does to your nervous system?
It makes me feel angry.
Ooh, so angry is the emotion that comes out.
Yes. Are the rest of my answers limited to 5 words? Because if so, I'm in big trouble because I'm a wordy boy.
I mean, it would make the show quicker, but no, you can do okay. all you want. So why anger?
I think for a number of reasons, evangelicalism as a religious organization, movement, entity makes me angry. I think that there is the personal, right? That I feel that I had years of my life taken from me, that I was so dedicated to a faith tradition and a God that I had made up and, you know, others around me had helped make up to limit who I am and how I function in the world, particularly as a queer person. Also as a person who has a brain in their head, that's what I think is frustrating too. And I feel, but I also feel a level of compassion for my former self, but I do feel a level of frustration with my former self that how in the world was I able to be duped so easily? I remember when I was in high school, I went back to my high school years after I went to my undergrad, which is the world's largest evangelical university. I went back to my high school to talk to teachers and one of them had said, Luke, it just never made sense to us why you were going to Liberty University, which is where I went for my undergrad, the world's largest evangelical school. And she said, it was, you were so bright, yet you were going there and you believed in this. And it's true. Like, I don't think I was dumb, but I also was apparently gullible enough to believe it. And so I think that I'm angry at a faith tradition and a group of people who fed this to me as ultimately fact, right? Like that it's framed as this is truth, capital T. And if you accept it or you go to hell, because if you don't accept it, the alternative is life apart from God for eternity. And so I think there was a lot of fear involved and I'm frustrated with my former self. Again, I still have a level of compassion for my former self, but I'm much more frustrated and much angrier with those who led me to believe that there was this really angry, vengeful God that was out to get me if I didn't submit to that God's redemption.
When you started to talk about this anger, you talked about a God that you had made up. And now you're talking about believing what other people had told you about this vengeful God. Is there something I'm misunderstanding about evangelicalism?
Well, I think it's a co-construction of this God, right? It's not just me that was making it up. It was not just those before me and after me who are making this God up. It's really sort of a collective enterprise that everyone's pushing a particular narrative. And again, I think within evangelicalism, a lot of what you find is, you know, regurgitation of the same thing over and over, but it takes individuals to believe what they believed. It takes individuals to construct what they believe. But again, like I said, it's a co-construction. It's not just you, it's other people who are influencing you and you influencing them, right? Yeah. And it's this mutual reinforcement of this system that ultimately results in what we see when we see evangelical churches and organizations and institutions today. But I think that it's not just them. I had to take responsibility too, right? Like I led people to Christ. Like I evangelized and brought people to faith in Jesus. And so like, was that everyone else's fault, not my own? No, it was certainly me who did that. And I still feel horrible about that. I still feel like I've done disservice to those people. But I also know that it was other people who were leading me in a certain direction, which makes me sound like a sheep, which I guess in a lot of ways I was. But also the Bible uses that metaphor as something to be, to identify with, that Jesus is the good shepherd and we are his flock as sheep. And so, you know, even that wasn't necessarily seen as like a negative thing. I followed the way that I thought I should and the way that I was told I should. So I think it's a both and that results in the Christian church or the evangelical church specifically, when it comes to both the individual and the group. Mm-hmm.
And you've talked about fear being one of the reasons that you stayed, but you've also talked about how you're annoyed at yourself about being gullible and to feel duped by it. I'm just going to come out and say this question rather than do this winding path towards the question. So basically, why were you duped? What are the reasons?
So I think that would have to take us back to my childhood, which was, I was born and raised in Toronto, Canada, and I'm the youngest of five kids. My mom was, I would say, haunted by her Baptist demons growing up, that she very much had a religious upbringing that lingered and affected her into her adulthood. Though she wasn't religious per se herself, she was certainly, you know, again, haunted by it. Whereas my dad was an agnostic. He didn't really believe in anything. He was this hippity-dippity, cool social worker / record store owner, super cool guy, wrote like a book on Bob Dylan. So I had this very funny sort of family dynamic where I had this very like easygoing dad and then this mom who had, again, was still affected by the secondhand sort of religiosity of her upbringing. And so when we were little, and since I'm the youngest, I had the least exposure to church. So my mom would bring us to church when we were little, but that stopped for me when I was in about grade 2 or 3. And so I did have exposure to the church. I wouldn't say I was raised in a Christian home, just given the fact that my mom, we never talked about God in our house other than saying our prayers and saying grace. Like, my mom taught us that, and that was the extent of our sort of religious dialogue within the home. And certainly with my dad, we never talked about that. I had the least exposure in my family. And I think by the time I was in high school, my brother, for whatever reason, got really involved in the creation versus evolution debate and had decided that there was such thing as, you know, a creator. And so he wrote me into listening to these DVDs that this guy was, had you know, produced. And I, at the time, was like, no, I'm not interested. And then finally, though, when he showed me these DVDs, I was like, oh, this is sort of, you know, it's intriguing. So started watching it. And then within, you know, a few months, I was like, well, if I believe that there's a creator, I must, you know, figure out who that creator is. And so I went back to the church that I went to when I was young. And I think part of that was feeling like I had missed out on something that my siblings had exposure to. And on top of that, I think it was also trying to appease my mom. I was definitely close with my dad, but I was always a mama's boy. And so I think that I was trying to satisfy her in some way. Yeah. Those are two reasons, again, feeling like I missed out on something and also trying to appease my mom. But I think on top of that, Christianity and religiosity in general provide queer folks with a really convenient cover for their sexuality. Mm-hmm. In the sense that if you're a Christian or you're an evangelical, according to this faith tradition, you cannot be gay. They even separate it from the individual. They say this is not, there's no such thing as queer people in the world. There are just people who, quote unquote, struggle with same-sex attraction, which is to divorce the sexuality from the individual or divorce the homosexuality from the individual. They say that's not an inherent or innate part of any individual. Everyone's a latent heterosexual who just might struggle or dabble with, you know, same-sex attraction. So I think for me, it was a very convenient cover. Like, I knew that if I were to be Christian, well, then I can't be gay because I'm Christian. And again, this false dichotomy, this binary black and white cosmology that allows for queer people to hide within religious traditions and not be questioned. Or if they are questioned, it's not a big deal because at the end of the day, the person who's questioning it knows that that person is you know, within the good graces of God and the community. So they're not going to run outside of the fold and, you know, run astray. Instead, they're going to stay where they are and be good Christian boys or good Christian girls and, you know, remain faithful. Even if there were people who were questioning my sexuality, it didn't matter to me because I was under the impression that I couldn't be gay and that ultimately it was a really sort of like neat narrative to, or fiction really, to uphold because I felt like I had beat the system, that no one was really ever going to know that I was gay because I was a Christian.
Okay, so then at what age did you become a Christian?
I became a Christian in grade 9, so I was 14. I went to Rosedale Heights School of the Arts, this very gay high school. And I, you know, one time I went into, I had said to my mom, "Mom, we should go to Sunday school, or we should go to like church or whatever." And she was like, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. And kept, you know, weeks and weeks of me dragging on, like, "Mom, come on, let's go to church. Let's go to church." She's like, I don't want to. And finally, one Sunday, she's like, "Let's go." So we go, because at this point we were like any good Canadian family would go to the cottage on the weekend or would just sleep in. Like, even though when I was young, she had pushed on this on us more. Mm-hmm. By the time I was in high school, she started drinking again, which she stopped doing when we were kids. And she, or for the most part, stopped. She was veering away from the church, but I, unfortunately, was veering towards the church. And so finally we go to church on Sunday. I see in the bulletin, like the pamphlet they hand out, I see in the bulletin that they have a youth group. And I'm like, oh shoot, I should go to youth group on Wednesday. So on Monday morning, I went to school, went to art class. And I said to my friend, Becky. Becky was like the kind of gal who had like the blonde spiked hair right at the middle, like the mohawk, and was always wearing like scantily clad. She was always scantily clad, like wearing black, like very goth kind of gal. And I went to Becky on Monday and I said, "Yo, would you want to go with me on Wednesday to church, to youth group?" And she was like, "Fuck yeah, I do." And so off to church we went on Wednesday, and Becky and I went. Needless to say, Becky didn't go back after the first time she went. I did. And the rest was her story.
But, okay. So you've talked about this finding religion as a way of covering your sexuality. Had you had the conversation with yourself about your sexuality at 14?
So my dad would never have cared. My dad passed away when I was in high school. I was 16. But before that, my dad never would have cared if any of us had come out as queer. Like, my dad was just so relaxed and easygoing. Whereas my mom, and I always knew that I should not tell my mom because she was adamantly homophobic. And we knew that, like all of us knew that. It was made very clear to me through a number of comments or conversations that, you know, she would have with me or others, or, you know, on the phone with her friends, or things she would say when we're watching TV and a queer person would come on TV, or when mm-hmm. the Pride Parade was happening in Toronto and we're driving out of the city to go to the cottage, she's talking about all those queers flopping their private parts around and how gross this is and all this kind of stuff. And she wasn't necessarily wrong that they were flopping their private parts around, but—
Yeah, but it's not gross. I mean, she's wrong there.
Yeah, come on, Cheryl. Get with the program. So I knew from an early age that it was not okay to talk about my sexuality. And as a result, I think I had convinced myself with very little evidence, and by very little, I mean no evidence at all, that I was bisexual. Like, I thought, well, you know, sometimes, you know, I'll see a man and a woman and I'll think she's pretty, that kind of thing. And you uphold fictions to fit the world that you're living in. And the world that I was living in precluded the possibility of being queer, right? Like, I knew that if I were to come out, I'd be in big trouble. So for me, I had convinced myself that I was bi. Then when I got involved in the church, this is when I learned the phrase struggling with same-sex attraction. Even though I didn't necessarily need to learn that specifically, I did know beforehand that you couldn't be, according mm-hmm. to the evangelical tradition, gay and Christian. This was, you know, they offered a, you know, a more detailed sort of vocabulary to talk about these things. However flawed that vocabulary is, I certainly learned it. And that was that if you struggle with same-sex attraction, again, it divorces the quote-unquote sin from the individual. And it's not something that you are. You aren't gay. It's something that you sometimes do, right? So that doesn't mean that you are defined by that thing that you sometimes do. Instead, it's just something that you sometimes do, in the same way that, you know, if you steal and you get tried in the court of law, you're guilty for that individual act of stealing, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're a thief for the rest of your life. It just means that you stole that one time. So this is the way that this was framed for me, that if you're same-sex attracted, sometimes you act on it and you do mm-hmm. that thing, but it doesn't mean that you yourself are gay, according, again, to this thinking. So that for me allowed me to convince myself.
Does that not just like give you lots of permission to go and do it?
Of course it does. That's a funny question, because so it absolutely does give you the license to go and do whatever you want. There are verses, though, within the Bible that say that just because you can sin doesn't mean that you should, kind of thing. You should be fleeing from this. You should be doing your best to follow Jesus. Now, all of that is cool. Well, not really, but, you know, for the purposes of argument's sake, it's real cool. But the thing is, when you're a teenager and you are a sexual being, just as much as everyone else who's a sexual being, you know, or maybe all the more with, you know, the hormones that are running through you.
I mean, yeah, those hormones, man.
Right? So with that, it's like you might be running away from sin. And you might ideally do your best to fight that and not look at porn, not masturbate, not even look at people that you found attractive. That's the ideal. Of course, we don't live in a world of ideals, and theology is, after all, theory. It's not necessarily based on our lived realities, or, you know, a lot of it's not, especially within the evangelical world. So when you have these like ideals or sort of like ways of being that you think you should follow, but don't, that's because, again, you're living into a world of theoretical, you know, formulations that are given to you. And again, they're these sort of like musings or thoughts about God or things that you should be doing or not doing. You know, when you're, again, you're a hormonal teenager, you're not necessarily always following that. You know, sometimes the quote unquote, the flesh is weak, right? And you need to be the human that you are and navigate that or negotiate that within yourself. But again, when you have this sexuality on the one side and hormones on the one side, and then you have this theory of how you should or ought to live on the other, they don't line up oftentimes, and especially within the evangelical paradigm. So it's like, yeah, you're fighting it. Yeah, you're doing your best not to give in to your temptations, quote unquote. But at the end of the day, you're a human. And at the end of the day, you're a hormonal teenager.
Yeah, but it's also, if you're viewing it as an action and not as part of your being or part of your identity, then it's super easy just to be like, well, yeah, I might have sucked 5 cocks this afternoon, but that's just an action and that's like not who I am. So I'm fine. I'm just going to keep going back to church. Like that's what I don't get.
Cade, I think you're absolutely onto it. Like, I think you have uncovered this sort of, in some ways, one of the many scandals of evangelicalism. And that is the intellectual dishonesty. That is the inconsistency in thinking. That is the ludicrous nature of so much of this, right? And I always say to people, don't look for this to make sense. Don't look for evangelicalism to make sense. There is a logic and there is a way of thinking about it, but you have to really sort of be familiar with that logic and how evangelicals twist and the mental gymnastics that they perform in order to believe what they believe. It's crazy. So I think what you're pointing out, you're saying like, wait a second, what about this? What about this? Absolutely. That's the whole thing, right? Like, looking back outside of this world, and you, of course, being an outsider and me no longer on that side of belief, I see it too. And I'm just like, yeah, this is so inconsistent. There are so many things that are wrong. There are so many things that the way that the system sets itself up is so sort of bonkers, right? And again, yes, people absolutely. So this is the thing. You'll have kids who are in youth group and they'll be like, I'm not looking at pornography until the day that I get married. Okay. Oh. A month in.
Oh, did you get a ring?
A purity ring?
A purity ring, yeah.
I did not. I did not.
I want to get one. Anyway, sorry, carry on your story.
I had the WWJD bracelet or the pro-life bracelet or like fully rely on God frog, that kind of thing.
Fully. I've never heard that. Okay, I'm going to have to go and get one of those bracelets. So anyway, kids in Sunday school.
So you have kids, yeah. So you have kids in youth group, Sunday school, church, whatever. They make the commitment. I'm never going to look at porn until I'm married. Of course, give them a month and they're on their computer at 12 o'clock at night when mom and dad have gone to bed and they're looking at porn and masturbating.
That's what the internet's for. Yeah.
Have they ever heard of Tumblr? So this is what they would do. And then, of course, like after the kid has done this, the kid's like, well, I've already looked at porn once and jerked off once. I might as well do it 5 more times. And so they would do it 5 more times and then feel really guilty about it. They'd be like, okay, back to God. And then they would, again, focus their eyes on all things pure and focus on Jesus and make sure and repent and say that, you know, I should never should have done this. God, I'm sorry. Like you've obviously forgiven me because of what you've done on the cross. Thank you for that forgiveness. And then they move on. And then they do the whole thing again the next month. It's this vicious cycle of over and over and over trying their best to be what they think they ought to be because they've been told this is who you ought to be, a sexually pure individual in the eyes of Christ. And then once they fail or they quote unquote slip up, that was the language that was used for me, which is like another way of saying sinning. After you sin, well, then you feel bad about it and then you feel contrite. The Holy Spirit's convicting you and then you go back to God and then you do it all over again. It's just this cycle and this is what happens and what ultimately this leads students or kids to. You have these young guys who are, I don't really know about, you know, women's experiences as well because I just haven't talked to a lot of women about this. But when I was in youth group, all we talked about was masturbation, pornography, and marriage because that's all we wanted. We wanted a way out of this vicious cycle. We wanted a woman. And of course, it's in such like objectifying terms. Like, I don't care who it is, just a woman to help me satisfy my needs. You know, I just need to find a wife to marry. And then you're out of this issue. But of course, that isn't going to work because a lot of people don't realize like the need or the desire for a variety. Like, they don't necessarily only want to have sex with one person. And then, of course, then they're looking at porn when they're married, or they're cheating on their wives when they're married, whatever it might be. And the cycle continues. And I think that this is where you find these restrictive, limiting sexual ethics that can find people into a really unrealistic way of living, to the point where they ultimately give up or explode and exceed the boundaries, or, you know, trespass, or again, to sin, quote unquote, because they've been living in such a narrow way of living that doesn't allow for human flourishing, but instead really limits that. And then eventually they just can't take it and they give up, and then they do things like cheat on their wives, or go on Grindr when they're not supposed to because they're married to a woman, that kind of thing.
Okay. So in these groups where you were talking about marriage, masturbation, and pornography.
Youth group.
The facilitator of this group, how would they not stop everyone from sharing notes and being like, hang on, this is a crock of shit. What the fuck are we doing here? What would they say?
For the most part, like, I was an exception to a lot of the kids in the youth group in the sense that my family wasn't like a church family. Uh-huh. So I was one person who had, you know, one foot in, one foot out. In the sense that, like, when I went home at night, like, I wasn't going back to my parents and saying, guess what God taught me tonight? Whereas a lot of these other kids are saying to their parents, they're talking about what God's doing in their lives and what how the Holy Spirit's convicting them, or what Jesus is teaching them, blah, 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 blah. And so for them, I think a lot of these kids were raised in this culture and raised in this community that they adopt such an uncritical position because it's been their whole lives for so long. And if they were to move outside of that, they would lose not only their community, but in their eyes, in a lot of ways, if they were to like say like, hey, I don't believe this about sexuality, or if I don't believe this about creationism, or if I don't believe this about take your pick, I'm no longer a Christian. Because again, the world of evangelicalism is set up in such a way that it's binary. There's of God, of the enemy, sinful, not sinful, or godly. It's either or. So they make it so that if you don't believe in everything, then you believe in nothing. And it's a slippery slope to start believing X, Y, and Z about sexuality because, well, the Bible says this. And if you don't believe this part of the Bible, then you don't believe any of the Bible because the whole Bible is God-inspired and God-breathed. Mm-hmm. They create a system that disallows questioning. They create a system that precludes asking why this is the case and why this isn't the case. And when there are really tough questions that are asked, which again, sometimes people do, but oftentimes it's encouraged not to. But when people do, the answer is oftentimes just, well, that's what God said, or that's what the Bible says, therefore. And so they create this system that disallows diversity and is resistant or allergic to difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's just futile for me to try and understand this, right? So let's move on. I want to better understand your headspace, I suppose, when you ran towards evangelical. Should I say Christianity? Should I say evangelical?
You can say Christianity. That's the broader category, but it still is absolutely accurate.
So yeah, I want to understand the headspace. So I'd asked if you had that conversation with yourself. You'd said that you were self-identifying as bisexual at the time. What was that the primary driver for you to be like, I can get away from this problem if I go towards this religion, or were there other layers wrapped in?
So my answer, the three-part answer, which is, you know, again, that my sexuality was one thing, that the cover for my sexuality, mm-hmm. the appeasing my mom, and then getting something that I felt that I had been excluded from or didn't have enough exposure to. I don't think any of that was a conscious reflection at the time. This is all hindsight. This is all me thinking about it now, or other people thinking with me. Sometimes, you know, in interviews, we'll be talking and someone will say something. And that's how it was actually a person from the BBC. He was saying, like, it sounds like you were just wanting to appease your mom. And I was like, oh, shoot. I've never thought about that one, but I think you might be onto something, right? So it's, you have these conversations, or you have your conversations with yourself and you're thinking about these things. And so it's much after the fact that I've come to these conclusions. But at the time, I think it was, again, with the creation versus evolution conversation that was, for me, it was led by this guy named he called himself Dr. Dino. Kent Hovind was his name. He went to jail eventually for tax evasion. He said that it was God's money, not Not the governments, but that's a different story. So Kent Hovind, he was very bombastic, right? Like he was so, he would have these debates with evolutionary biologists or anthropologists or whomever. And he would have these debates with them. And he was very, he used a lot of rhetorical moves that made it seem like it was just so crazy to believe in evolution. And can you believe that they think you came from apes or monkeys or whatever, like that kind of thing. And so the way that he did it, the way that he framed it, the way that he talked about it was really, for a high school kid, alluring because it was so simple, but it was also so theatrical in how he was doing it. So I think like that for me was in some ways a hook, not necessarily that which kept me there, but a hook that brought me in. And then from there, I think there was also that, and I, to be honest, I never really struggled with making friends. I always, you know, had pals. But evangelicalism presents to you that you're going to have a built-in community that will accept you no matter what. Of course, you find out really quickly once you no longer believe what they believe that there never was this unconditional acceptance or love. Mm-hmm. The moment you give up your faith, they want nothing to do with you and they don't come after you because they just don't care about you. They care about themselves and they only care for themselves. But I think that at the time I was under the delusion that I had this built-in community and that people were really taking interest in me, particularly the youth pastor and youth leaders who were older than me. And so, of course, when you're a 14-year-old kid and you have the affirmation of a 21 to 25 or 6-year-old guy, and especially when you're a queer kid, all of a sudden you're like, wow, like this guy wants to come to my high school and eat pizza with me during my lunch break. No one comes to my high school other than, you know, my friends. And so when the youth pastor shows up and wants to hang out, you feel special, right? And that is true. He did come and eat pizza with me. He also tripped and fell in front of all my friends and with the pizza in hand. But that's a different story. And so...
Is it a long story? It doesn't sound like much of a story.
No, that was the story. It was just a different story. It just wasn't this story, okay? So, yeah, there are all these things that you, at the time... This is what you're thinking about. This is what you're like, wow, like this guy thinks I'm cool enough that he's going to show up at my high school, again, with pizza, and I'm going to be like hanging out with a 20, whatever
year old. Did your high school not have any safeguarding laws or rules?
No, like in the States, I think that a lot of like campuses are like pretty closed off given like the gun issues.
So whereas they just let some random adult come into your school and have lunch with you.
Well, this was the thing. So this was early into the school year. So this would have been like September, maybe October that this was happening. So it was still time where you could eat outside and eat outside comfortably without even a coat. It was nice weather.
But so, are there no teachers like walking around being like, hang on, there's a grown adult there eating pizza with those kids. I better go and investigate.
No, I don't think so. Because we were out in the front lawn and the front lawn, I guess teachers would sometimes come out, but not really.
I'm going to have to do a bit of an expose on the Canadian education system. This is a bit chilling, really.
No, I swear my high school was great. It actually was a great high school. They put up with me, right? Like I was the Christian kid that they had to put up with. And I feel terrible that they had to like deal with Luke Wilson at the age of 14 to 17. Because geez Louise, I was not a fun character when it came to classes. Because I was always like, but that's not what I believe. And I believe this and I believe this. And teachers were just like, shut up. But they put up with it. They put up with it.
So did you like go to the Natural History Museum and be like, those dinosaur bones are not real? And then
I actually wrote an optional paper. And by optional, I have to say I chose to write a paper for my teacher in grade 9. He never asked for it, but it was the reasons why evolution is incorrect and why it's scientifically inaccurate. And I handed it to him one morning and he was kind of like, oh. And I remember he just kind of slowly like walked away and was like reading it as he walked away. And I was just like, I did a good thing. Like I really taught him. And he probably just went to like the other teachers in the department were like, what the hell is this? But like, yeah.
Thank goodness we have a shredder in here.
Exactly. He put his like coffee mug on it and spilled. It was a coaster at best. I thought I was doing the Lord's work.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you throw yourself in, you're like, I'm all in, I'm going to never masturbate again, I'm going to never watch pornography again, I'm not even going to think about breasts or penises or nipples or areolas or whatever. At what point were you like, actually, maybe this isn't for me?
Like Christianity wasn't for me? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Is that the... Okay.
Sorry. No, I'm talking about porn.
No. If I think Christian... Like, by the time... So I went to divinity school eventually, And it's one of the most like liberal divinity schools in the US. It's called Vanderbilt University and they have a divinity school there. So it was there that I decided that I didn't believe that the Bible was God's words, but instead I believe that these were words about God, which sounds like such a small difference or maybe nuance, but it's not just a nuance. This is like a world of a difference for an evangelical. Evangelicals believe that the Bible are literally like the Bible as it is written in English or in any language are the words of God. Like God said these things through man. And it always is man because no woman wrote the Bible, right? And we do know that. But like man's pen was God's tool to write God's words down for humanity. But I switched at divinity school that I'm like, I don't think I believe that God said these words. I believe these are words about God. And at the time, I was still a Christian. I was still a person of faith. And it didn't mean that the Bible was any less sacred to me. It still was a sacred text. It still was something that was important to me and had some sort of influence in my life. But ultimately, I didn't really think that I needed to believe that these were God's words. And I didn't, and not that I didn't need to believe, but I didn't believe. I was like, there's so much in here that's absolutely horrible. One scholar, Phyllis Tribble, she refers to these certain passages as the texts of terror. And these texts of terror, these are passages within the Bible. And one example is there's a guy and he says to God, he says, God, whoever walks out that door over there next, I will kill for you. And who walks out that door but his daughter? And guess what he does? He kills his daughter. Like, and the fact that you would, if anyone would ever to believe that God wrote this and that God was saying, hey, you know, this guy, it was right for him to not only have killed someone, but killed his own daughter because of promising stupidly to me that he was going to kill whoever was coming out that door. That's bonkers. And for me, that was one reason of many that I was like, I can't believe these are God's words anymore because these are really awful. And so
example, though, did you believe that had happened and someone had recorded it or that it was just written by man as a way of demonstrating how loyal we should be to God? I mean, I don't even know what the lesson there is.
You tell
don't
me.
Don't use doors, maybe.
So beforehand, I would have said these are God's words. God intended this to be written, that this was orchestrated by God.
Yes, but had he written it based on events that had happened, or had he written it as a demonstration of like making a point?
When I was evangelical, I believed that these were based on historical events. Yes, okay, that this actually happened. Afterwards, heck no. Like I didn't believe that this happened. And again, I couldn't wrap my head around a God who would do that. And so I absolutely didn't believe that these were events that happened, or if they were events that happened, that this person was stupid. Whoever did this was dumb. Like that was how I started to conceptualize it. Again, it wasn't like this whole like grand, I now understand everything that I now believe about the Bible. That was just this quick shift. I remember I was sitting in class. I still remember where I was sitting. I was sitting in the back of the class. I normally sit in the front of the class, but for whatever reason, I was sitting in the back of the class and I was sitting there and I was like, huh, I don't think I believe that God wrote the Bible. And that was just like, my mind blew. Like it was like this paradigm shift. And so when that happened, that was the first of many paradigm shifts, because there were many, that I thought, I don't believe that God really cares that I'm gay. I don't really think that God really is going to send people to hell. All these things started shifting to the point that, and there are a lot of Christians who don't believe in hell.
I feel like that's a hard one to let go of, right? Because that one's properly drummed
so
in.
So do I. Yeah. No, I'm with you. Again, I think that Christians do a lot of mental gymnastics in order to keep within the faith tradition while also making room to get outside of it. And I commend them in some ways. I also think that a lot of what they think is just, I question like, why are you so committed to this belief system when in fact you don't believe in a lot of it, but then you do believe in it, but you change your beliefs here and that you accommodate this. And for me, I'm not invested in Christianity anymore. I'm not invested in keeping up with that. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are, and that's their own investments and that's that. For me, when it stopped making sense is when I gave it up. I was like, this doesn't make sense anymore. And for me, most of my past research, I finished my PhD last year, and most of my research was in Holocaust studies. And so I looked at, really, a lot of it was actually the intergenerational transmission of trauma from Holocaust survivors to the kids to their grandkids.
Oh, that's fascinating.
But before that, I was doing work in like survivor narratives. I was doing work on Nazi propaganda. I was doing work on like Christianity's role in the Holocaust and how the Christian theology and the Christian scriptures themselves laid the seedbed for the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. A lot in there. And when I was reading specifically this one author, Elie Wiesel, who is perhaps the best known Holocaust survivor. If Anne Frank is the best known Holocaust victim, Wiesel is probably the best known survivor. And I was reading a lot of his work for this class that was on him. And I remember sitting there, and I think it was some sort of like Instagram or Facebook post where this someone I knew had wrote that God had given them a free Starbucks coffee. Praise the Lord, God gave me this free Starbucks coffee. What a gift. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, and I'm reading Elie Wiesel, right? I remember still sitting on my couch in my apartment on A1A, like the first, like the Highway 1 in Florida, which faced the ocean. And I'm sitting there and I'm on my couch and I'm just like, wait a second. And it was, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. This is where my entire faith honestly just like unraveled before me. I was sitting there and I was thinking, okay, this gal is saying that God gave her a Starbucks coffee. And of course, if God gives you something, that's an active decision that God has made in order to give someone something. And if God is actively giving some things to some people, but then actively not giving things to other people, that's also a decision. So God's making these decisions to give something to some, not to others. I was like, wait a second, why in the world would God be giving some to some and not to others? And why would God be acting here but not acting here? Wait a second, how can God act here and not act here when, of course, there's so much like suffering in this person down here who needs a Starbucks coffee or needs, you know, a pastry from Starbucks in order to survive? That person's not getting that, but that woman who's like really well off and, you know, living her whatever, like pumpkin spice latte fantasy, she's getting a free coffee from God, but doesn't need it. I was like, I don't believe in that God. There's no way that I believe in that. And I'm thinking about the Holocaust all of a sudden. Again, I go from like Starbucks to the Holocaust. And I was like, wait a second, where was God during the Holocaust? And if God was acting for some people, but not acting for others, that's pretty messed up. And I can't believe in a God that would act here, but wouldn't act here. I said, no way, Jose, like, that's it. And so from there, I still believed that there was a God, but I believed that God was inactive, that God didn't act, God didn't do or intercede in our world in any way, because if God did, then that's messed up. But then I started just kept going after that, and, you know, eventually I just kind of did away with the idea of God altogether. I believe that there's some sort of creator. I don't really know what the heck that is. I think something is involved, whatever that something is. I don't know and I don't care, to be honest. But this was the unraveling. It was a Starbucks coffee and blessings and act, God's ability to perform miracles. And then ultimately how that connected to the Holocaust, it just blew my faith up in my face.
But how big was the coffee? Was it a grande, a latte, a venti?
It was a no foam with whip, no water chai latte.
I can see how that blew your faith up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a mess. Milk everywhere.
So when you have that realization and you're like, everything that I ever thought is wrong, what do you do next?
I'll start this by saying all my supervisors have always been Jewish men, but my PhD supervisor, Dr. Berger, who's one of my favorite people in this entire world, he one time said to me, he said, Luke, are you sure you're not Jewish? Your anxiety's through the roof. And you know what? When I gave up my faith, I was living in Florida and it was awful. I had just had this like breakup that I somehow let my world unravel because of this breakup. And looking back, like the man was just like, anyway, he's not even worth talking about. He was not a very good human, but I was like distraught over it. And I was so upset. And this is again, around the same time that I had lost my faith. Or I'd given up my faith, maybe is more accurate. I don't know if I can say lost, but whatever. And I was so anxious about specifically death. That was the big thing for me. Because in the past, I had this belief that when I die, I'm going to heaven. There, I'm going to see my dad. I'm going to see my friends. I'm going to see, you know, my family members. I'm going to see so-and-so. I'm going to see Jesus. And that's going to be great.
What about the youth pastor that ate pizza with you? Would you see him there?
He would have been there according to that faith. Yes, definitely would have been there. But I remember that. And I think that like that gives you such a sense of security and such a sense of assuredness that you know that when you die, no questions, you're going to heaven. And you're going to see Jesus. You're going to be in, eternal fellowship with God. Cool. Well, of course, when I stopped believing in that God, I lost that. And I was so anxious for so long that I was going to... No, I just didn't know. There were no absolutes anymore. There was no assuredness or blessed assurance, should I say.
But in that line of thinking, were other people going to go to heaven and you weren't because you didn't believe anymore? Or was it that, heaven doesn't exist? So what the fuck?
No, it's like when Christians will say, if I said to a Christian, like, I don't believe I'm going to hell, they're like, well, it doesn't matter what you believe. God's going to send you there if you don't repent and turn your life over to Christ. At this point, I was like, it doesn't matter what Christians believe, if I'm going to hell, like, it's just not true. It's just not possible. There's no way that God is the way that they say that God is. And great, they can say whatever they want, but I just don't believe it. And I know that it's not going to happen.
Okay. So it wasn't like FOMO. It was more like, oh, what the hell?
I missed the security of it. And I missed the security of knowing, or of believing more accurately, that I was going to go to heaven. Mm-hmm. I missed the security of saying, I know what's going to happen when I die. And of course, with death, it's pretty final. It's pretty absolute. And I thought to myself, without God, what? I no longer have that sort of belief that everything will be good and I'll be, you know, on the other side of eternity in a great way.
Okay.
It was a slow transition into, by the time I was 27, that's when I officially said goodbye to Jesus.
Aww.
Yeah.
Is there a greeting card for that?
A grieving card or a greeting card?
Greeting.
Maybe both. Yeah, I don't know. There have been times throughout my life since that I've missed not God, but a sense of security, a sense of comfort, a sense of like when no one else can necessarily say what you want them to say to you, that you believed that there was something that was listening and loved you regardless. I missed that. I think maybe sometimes I still continue to miss that, but it, not enough for me to go back to it, because if I were to go back to it, that'd be so dishonest because I don't believe it. But I miss that security, or that false sense of security.
Yeah. And how much of the appeal is smugness?
What do you mean?
There's something quite alluring about being like, I know the answer, guys, and I'm going to heaven, and I got it all figured out, and you losers don't get free Starbucks coffees. Like, surely that kind of keeps you in the fold, right?
Yeah, you feel like you have all the answers. You feel like you know the secrets to the universe. You feel like God has chosen you. Right? And that divine sort of selection, you know, that when you have that, you feel special, right? And I think you're right. There is a certain smugness that comes along with that. And I was a smug little jerk. You know, again, my teachers in high school, and then even my friends probably had to put up with a lot of stupidity because I was like, again, talking to adults like they were the silly ones. It's like when you go to the zoo and there's an animal looking at you like, who's this crazy person? You're like, you're the one in the cage, my friend. And I was the one in the cage who was looking at everyone else like they were crazy.
Oh, you've said that before.
Oh, my brother came up with that one. Quinn, shout out to you for that metaphor. It was, or simile, I guess.
I'm
what you call very derivative. I just steal from my siblings and my friends.
So I need to admit that I had thought we would naturally land on Albuquerque somewhere in this conversation, and we haven't. So shall we?
Do you want
me
to naturally bring it to Albuquerque?
No, let's just abruptly end up in Albuquerque. So why don't we set the scene a bit? What brought you to Albuquerque?
So I was doing my master's, my MA in English, and I had gotten into a conference to present my work in Albuquerque. And so I, you know, got funding to go down and get a hotel and, you know, present my work, which looking back was just such bad work. Like it was so poorly done, but I was all excited and I get on my plane. I go back to the States where I'd done my undergrad in Virginia, but I went all the way to New Mexico for this conference. And I remember I got out of the airport and I was very excited because I was like, okay, I'm going to go straight to the gas station and pick up two things, beer, because I loved Blue Moon beer, it's an American beer. And I was also going to pick up chewing tobacco because when I was at Liberty, it was against the rules, but we all, like a bunch of us on our hall, we all did dip, like chewing tobacco. And so it was chewing tobacco and beer. So I go to the store, I go to the, you know, gas station or a 7-Eleven, whatever it was, pick it up. And then the taxi takes me to my hotel. I chugged like four beers and I was like, okay, I'm ready. Time to go out to the club. And so I go to this club and I'm waiting in line and I'm standing there and I hear these guys ahead of me and they're talking about the cover charge. And I had never been to a bar other than once. And that was, it had no cover charge. And my cousin was with me, which a different story. He wanted to go to a gay bar randomly. I don't know why, but he did. And I went with him pretending I was straight. Anywho, long story short, I'd only been to one bar before and I had never encountered a cover charge. And I only brought like so much money with me, like cash wise. And so I'm looking at my $40 that I brought with me, and I'm like, $20 for a cover charge? Then I have $20 for drinks, aka two drinks. I was like, gosh darn it, like this isn't gonna work. So I hear them talking about it, this group of guys in front of me, and they're all so handsome, right? Or not all of them, most of them were. And so I said to, I tapped one of them on the shoulder. I said, hey, how much did you say is cover? And they said, $20. And they said, why, have you never been here? And I said, no, I've never been here. I said, I'm not from here. And they said, where are you from? And this was, looking back, I don't know why I lied about this. Also, I should say evangelicalism really teaches you to lie for a lot of things. So this time I was like, I don't want to tell them where I'm from and then them find out who I am and then, you know, them tell my friends and family that I'm gay. This is the year after Liberty and I was living back in Ontario. Again, this is where your mind goes. This, and I don't know how I thought they would ever find out anything.
Or that they would have the energy to bother.
Yeah, exactly. I was up there and be like, let me go out him to his friends and family. Like, what? But evangelicalism teaches you, it instills a lot of fear in you, and this is what you think, and you think they're going to find out. So I lied and said that I went to Duke. Because at the time, I was applying to Duke for grad school for my other master's. I eventually got into Duke, but I didn't go. I went to Vanderbilt instead. But I was like, I'll tell them that I go to Duke. I'm on the soccer team. And that I'm here for a conference. Like, what grad student is on the soccer team at Duke, right? But anyway.
Was it a soccer conference? What kind of conference?
No, it was a popular culture and like literature conference. And I'm like, yeah, I'm here for that, but I'm a soccer player.
Oh, no. But I'm saying like in your made up scenario, was it a soccer conference?
No, I told them exactly what conference it was, which again, if they really wanted to figure things out, they could have gone to the conference and found out that I was representing McMaster University, not Duke University. But I think part of it also was that I knew that gays, nowadays, I don't think this is as much a thing, but I think 10-ish years ago, this would have been, 2012, 2013, in between there. So 10 years ago, I feel like at least, in the States and in Canada, it was really cool to be like an athletic gay. And like, I mean, I guess in some ways it still is like kind of hot to be, doing anything with an athlete. So I lived into that fantasy. And they were all immediately, it worked. Like they were all just like, oh my gosh, like, did you hear that? He goes to Duke and he's on the soccer team. Because Duke's, of course, like a Southern Ivy League. Everyone thinks it's this amazing school. And I guess it is a great school. But nonetheless, it was just like I was living out a fantasy and I was living into their fantasies. And so they were all just like blown away. And they were like, what's your name? Who are you? And I was like, but I'm also Canadian. And of course, Americans find that just crazy. They're like, oh my gosh, a Canadian in New Mexico. Like, I've never met such a person. And so, it was all these like silly boxes I was, I guess, checking. And this one guy, he says to me, he goes, how much money did you bring tonight? I said, I only brought $40 and we're still in line. He goes, how about this? I'll pay for your cover. And anytime you want to drink, I'll pay for it. Just stick with me. And this was the guy who I didn't find very cute.
Always the word.
I said, oh man. I said, no, you don't have to do that. I said, don't worry about that. Like you keep your money kind of thing. And he's like, no, I'm paying for you to get in. And I was like, you don't have to. He's like, no, I will. I said, oh, okay. If you insist, but I'm not going to like be standing next to this guy for the rest of the night. And so sure enough, he's trying. And I'm like trying to like get away at any point I possibly can. And I'm like running over here. And then by the end of the night, there was this couple who I guess were fighting and they weren't going to be like interested in like, having a smooch at the end of the night, nor was this other guy. But this one guy who I thought was so handsome, he was. And so we started dancing and having a good time and, a great evening. But this was all my first time at a gay bar, and I had never, again, other than technically with my cousin, but it was technically a strip club, and it was very weird, and we got out within a few minutes. But this time was, like, the very first time that I showed up and actually participated in, like, queer life really ever.
So you've jumped ahead and just ran into a story and told me the whole evening. Can we go back? Was this premeditated, yes. Basically, is the first question I have. You're flying into New Mexico. You know you're going to be at the conference. You know you're going to have this hotel. You've already pre-planned to buy the beer that you want to buy and get some chewing tobacco. And
the dip, yeah.
Yeah, but on the plane on the way in there, were you like, yeah, this is it. This is the opportunity for me to dip my toe in this water. This water, this lake, this is my chance to have some fun and let loose. Or was it more of a spur of the moment thing?
Again, like when I was at Liberty, the Christian undergrad, you couldn't really be doing a lot of gay anything because if you were caught, you'd get kicked out. And when I was at McMaster, where I did my MA, I always felt nervous to do anything in the city because I thought people would find out somehow, or the church I was going to would find out. And I was essentially leading a youth group with a friend at that point every Friday night. And so I was very nervous and apprehensive to do anything there. So when I eventually did come out in Nashville, when I went to Vanderbilt, that's when I felt free to do this. But this was the sort of moment of freedom beforehand that I was like so excited about, because it was the first time I'd gone back to the States. And of course, when I go to the States, I'm not in the same country. I'm not in a place where anyone knows me or I know anyone. And it's going to allow me to just be myself, or to be free. Or in this case, I guess I would have conceptualized it as take a night off and away from God and live in sin for a night and then come back and repent and everything would be fine. Because even in high school, I always thought that I can never do anything with any guys, because if I do, I'm going to give Jesus a bad name. I'm going to be a bad Christian witness. And here I just thought, well, I just won't tell anyone.
Why would you be giving Jesus a bad name?
Because if I were doing anything gay, according to Christian theology, that's bad, that's wrong, that's sinful. So you can't reconcile that with God. So if you're doing that, what kind of Christian are you that you're kissing boys and going on dates with boys? That was my big fear. But in Albuquerque, I just planned I wasn't going to tell anyone, and no one knew me. So I wasn't going to be giving Jesus a bad name, and I could just do what I want anonymously in some senses and then go home and everything would be fine.
Okay, so I'm not going to scratch at the logic here, but why don't we? Sorry.
There's no logic to scratch at.
Okay, so this was like a big deal.
This was huge. This was so exciting. This was, again, it was entrance into a world that I had never been granted access, or I never allowed myself to be granted access. I did not identify as gay. Again, I identified still at this point as bisexual somehow, okay, even though I had never been attracted to women. And I, even though I identified as bisexual or someone who struggled at this, again, struggled with same-sex attraction,
Can we make an acronym out of that?
SSA.
SWSA.
SSA, same-sex attraction.
Oh, okay. So it's not struggling with.
Well, the struggling with is part of the phrase, but the actual phrase itself is same-sex attraction. It's just that people use the verb to struggle with.
To struggle with SSA. Okay.
Yeah.
I might try that out.
We should revive that, huh? We should bring that back and like just see what people think.
Yeah, like I'm thriving with SSA.
If there's one thing I'm good at, it's SSA. It's no longer a struggle. It's very much an embrace, but yeah. You were saying something. Oh, to your question about like the space itself and going into the bar, I just remember it was like this world that all of a sudden, it's like Narnia, right? Like you go into this world and you've heard about these things. You've seen some porn that would like gesture towards spaces like these, but not really.
Who's looking at the space in porn? What?
Where are we? Why are we in the middle of a gay club? So it was like, I remember walking in and like there was this big room that was like the dance floor. And then there were also other rooms upstairs. You can go smoke and all this kind of stuff. And I remember just like walking around in awe of this space that, you know, in some ways a club is in a lot of ways like a church, right? You have the music, you have the community, you have like, I guess you could even say the communion. Of course, you're not getting drunk off the wine from communion, but there are so many parallels in like the way that you move your body and the way when you're praying together, like you move your body together. There are like so many structural parallels that underlie these two different social experiences. And for me, I'm not saying that my time my first time at the gay bar was spiritual. It wasn't. But it certainly was like profound, and it certainly was something.
And you did get on your knees.
I certainly did. And I think that it was such a different experience, but at the same time, I guess it was uncanny in the sense that there were parts that were familiar and there were parts that I was like, oh, that's like this or that's like this. And it left me reeling. Like for days and weeks, I couldn't stop thinking about, specifically, I became obsessed with like the idea of like going back to Albuquerque. I was like, oh my gosh, I could maybe go to grad school there, or I could do like this there. And like, it became such a profound moment for me that I don't know, I felt a sense of belonging in a way that I hadn't before. Cause these guys sort of latched onto me and like brought me into their fold. Again, I was brought into the other fold, the evangelical fold before that, but this was different, and it felt really authentic. And I'm not to say that my evangelical sort of like, acceptance or whatever at the time didn't feel authentic. It did, but this felt authentic in a different way. And it's something that I was craving and desiring for so long, and I finally had, even if, in a fleeting way, even if just for one night.
Mm-hmm. You've said that it was premeditated on the plane, flying in. You knew this is what you were going to do. What does that feel like?
Oh, exhilarating. Exhilarating. I've talked about this with some friends since, and like talking about when you would, you know, look at porn, or when you would whatever, when you weren't supposed to, quote unquote, right? When you were a Christian, and how much more exciting it was. Mm. Like, it was thrilling. There was such a thin line between the fear and the desire. Mm. You were desiring this so much, but of course, the moment you were found out, it would have been like fear and terror. Like, oh gosh, what if someone finds out, or blah, blah, blah. So I remember just like any time that you knew you were going to be doing something bad, it was just exciting as all get out. And so there was that, like that specific time. There were other times where, again, like you'd go to your, like when I first got to Nashville and I was going to bars there finally. And, you know, that was thrilling because it was just like, I shouldn't be doing this, quote unquote, but I am. And so you would just get ultra giddy, ultra excited. Everything was just so new because at that point I had lived such a sheltered life and I didn't know much about anything in general, but especially not about anything gay. Mm. And so when you now have literal entrance into a gay space, it's, again, you feel like you're crossing into Narnia. You feel like you're going into a place that's magical that you've never inhabited.
And so when something is that thrilling and that exciting, it's also terrifying. Was there any risk that you were going to not go through with it?
There wasn't a risk that I wasn't going to go through with it. There was a risk in my mind that I was going to die on the plane home and go to hell kind of thing. Right?
Like, but couldn't you repent before the plane took off?
Oh, for sure, for
sure. Isn't that how it works? You just repent as soon as it's over?
You do. You do. You absolutely do. And oftentimes that works. However, for an anxious mind like my own, and there's like theology within Christianity that once saved, always saved. You can't lose your salvation. But there are verses within scripture that do gesture towards the possibility that you can, in fact, lose your salvation. This is what, again, it's such a genius construction that evangelicals and Christians in general have made. They say you can't, you're not going to lose your salvation. Once you're saved, you're always saved, and Jesus' blood never fails. However, exactly. It's always the door that's a little bit open, right? So yes, I could have afterwards, you know, repented and said, God, I'm sorry for what I did. Please forgive me. Amen. But there was always the sort of like, but what if? Like, what if I shouldn't have done that and it just wasn't good enough? My prayer, like there was just always these mental sort of like obstacles. And again, like gymnastics you'd have to perform. You'd have to sort of like navigate and negotiate after any sort of like big moment of sin. And this for me was a big moment of sin.
Ah. So you were adamant though, you were definitely going. You were just worried about the repercussions once you got on the plane.
Yeah, that plane might crash. Yeah, I was, part of why this trip was so exciting was because I could just go and be myself.
Uh-huh.
And again, no one knew me, I didn't know anyone. And that anonymity allowed for me to feel excited that I was actually going to go do it, because I wouldn't have done this at home. I think Albuquerque for me opened up the possibility of again, like living into my queerness. But at that point, I think it was the slow progression towards not caring, because I still cared, but giving in and just being like, you know what? I can't fight this anymore. And I'm not going to fight this like I used to. I still remember there was one night I was in Hamilton at the school, McMaster. I had just finished washing the dishes this is just after Albuquerque, and I was washing the dishes and I was in my basement apartment and I'm there over the sink and it was like, you know, just one light on washing these dishes. And I'm thinking and I'm praying to God and I'm just like, God, how in the world can I have I tried so hard for so long? I've tried and I've tried and I've tried and I've tried to be straight. I went to Pastor Dane, who was my conversion therapist. I went to him for 4 years. I've been praying. I fasted. I cannot tell you how, it would have been months in total that I fasted. Not all at once, but if you count up the weeks, because I would fast for a week every time. When I fasted, it would have been months that I had fasted at this point. You know, I'd prayed. I had read my Bible. I had evangelized. I had brought people to Christ. I had done everything and anything that I possibly could that I thought was right within the eyes of God, especially as it related to me fighting against what I described, again, as my same-sex attraction, or in this case, bisexuality, whatever. And nothing had changed. Mm. And I was over that sink and I was like sobbing. I was just like, again, in part the guilt from going to Albuquerque, but then on top of that, like just like the guilt of like, and then the shame and the self-hatred that comes with it of being queer and just thinking, what is going on? How is it that I just can't fight this? I just can't like give this up. And so at that point, it slowly started being where I was like, okay, I'm going to, you know, hook up with this person who knows I'm a Christian. And then when I get to Nashville, again, they knew I was in divinity school, but I was just like, you know what? Like, fuck it. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to finally like live the life that I want to live. And so it became this like slow progression towards just doing what I wanted to do. And I think a big part of that was that within Christianity, you theologize first. So you have this set theory about God that you put in front of you and you let that be the guiding rubric of your life. And you live after your theology. So in other words, you have the theory that sets up how you're supposed to live. I was like, I'm going to live and let that dictate what theory I believe about the world. So I started to switch that sort of like MO, that like way of being. I was like, I'm not going to just theorize first and then live. I'm going to live and then theorize. Mm-hmm. And that's when, again, I started living and being me and going on dates or going to gay clubs or whatever, and then letting that affect how I saw God, how I saw myself, how I saw others, how I saw the world around me. I was going to let the lived experience determine the theory, not the theory determine the lived experience. And I think that was a much more authentic way of being.
But so then what is the theory?
That sex isn't bad. I guess that is, at the end of the day, a postulation.
That's a fairly non-committal theory.
Yeah, how profound, you know? Like, jeez.
But it's not even like sex is amazing. It's like, yeah, sex. Yeah, it's not that bad.
sex is not morally bad.
Oh, you mean morally bad. Oh, I thought you were like, yeah, sex is okay.
Yeah, take it or leave it. You're like, what? You've been fighting this long for that?
But you know about butt stuff, right?
Yet to be discovered. No, it's, I think that for me, it's, how do I say that again, like for someone, and again, this might not sound profound at all for someone who doesn't have a religious background or wasn't steeped in it for so long, that who I am as a queer person is okay. But that was a radical statement for me when I first started living into who I am, that it's okay to be me. Like, again, that sounds so sort of like pedestrian and like duh and obvious. But for me at the time, that was wild. That was crazy to think, because I had been told for so long that simply being myself was not okay, that it was wrong, that I need to change. And again, I tried. I went through 4 years of conversion therapy.
Yeah, that again, is commitment.
She did her best, gave it the good old college try. But, you know, I think that for me, like, it was these little steps, these little realizations or like epiphanies, which, you know, at the time, these like moments of illumination, like that over time, again, became so obvious. And to this day, they're obvious now. But at the time, they were revolutionary. These were things that changed my life, that it was these little baby steps that opened the door to that I can now, that is now completely open versus before it was closed because I didn't have the tools to open it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to.
How did this mystery bar in Albuquerque help with those illuminations and little aha moments?
They were the first people. I had met people in high school who were queer and out, but even in high school, it was different because like, it wasn't like all the gay guys just hung out together because they're all gay. It was an art school. So it was like, everyone was friends with everyone. So you had straights and gays and women and, you know, who were straight and like some lesbian women and like, you
and
know,
women.
All sorts of like women in general. No, like, you know, straight women and then, you know, lesbian women. And they were all sort of together. It wasn't like there was a group of them. And I think that was something that I always wanted, was to have like a gay group, you know, and I never had it. And when I met these guys, I saw them and they were just this like, and I'm trying to think right now, like look back about the gay guys in high school. I can't really remember many of them like flocking together. It was oftentimes like one gay guy, three girls, or like one gay guy, straight guy, and like five girls, like, you know. And this was the first time I had seen like a group and a community of gay guys living their lives as adults and being, you know, successful. Like one guy was in med school, the other guys were like doing whatever they were doing. And I was like, geez, like this is something I've never had. I don't know what the first thing is. I don't know what it would be like to have a group like this, but I felt so fitting. It felt so correct, right? Like that I could just be myself with these other gay guys. And it made me, again, that it set off this like series of of experiences where I was just craving that and wanting more of that, to the point where now I've got a big old gay group of friends here in Toronto and I love it. I've got, you know, good gay friends out in, you know, New York or whatever, like San Francisco. But like, at least I have my like group of like gay pals who I just have that. And that's so exciting. And that I think that what I saw in New Mexico laid the groundwork or the framework for what I would eventually call my own, which was a group of homos who are my friends.
Do you have any memories of queer clubbing that you want to share? Well, if you do, I would love to hear all about it, so why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I can't do it alone and I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. And I especially love embarrassing photos, so I will be looking out for those. You can also reach me on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, where I am Lost Spaces Pod. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast player of choice, or just tell other people who you think might be interested in giving it a little listen too. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.